able to, you know, talk about this stuff in a more public level with some kind of credibility. And this is a really widely debated topic. Last time I was talking a bit about Socrates and Sophists, the Sophists believed that in a sense you could train people to be intellectuals in the public sphere. Socrates denied this. Socrates thought that in fact it was one of these things that in a sense you had to do for yourself, right? Once you had the leisure and you didn't have to work for a living, you had this opportunity to sort of contemplate ideas, right, and to think about the nature of truth and all of this kind of stuff. And because you didn't have any kind of practical aim in mind, you had a kind of clear vision, but this is not something you could be trained for particularly. Alright? And these two views kind of have come down through the ages with people on either side. Last week, after I gave my last lecture, I flew off to the U.S. and I gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee where they're establishing a program on strategic intellectual communication. Okay? And this is supposed to be kind of a way of training public intellectuals. Now, one of the things that I've mentioned in the course outline in relation to this is that there was a program started at Florida Atlantic University a couple of years ago, and I'll send you the details about that, and it's closed. It's already after 2 years, it's dead. Okay? And had gotten a lot of publicity in its day. There have been other attempts as well. So last night I gave a talk at Birkbeck College, London, which is the Ninth School of the University of London, and there they have an institute for ideas and intellectual life, and they have as the sort of flagship person directing the place, Slavo Žižek. You familiar with this guy, Žižek? Have you heard of him? How many have heard of him?
No. Do you mention him in one of your books?
Well, yes, I do, but that's the reason. Okay, you get brownie points. But other than my mentioning him, I don't know, they have all sorts of accents in this language, but Slovenian. Slavo Žižek, does this name look familiar to anybody? No, huh? Pretty amazing, considering he is considered one of the leading intellectuals in the world today, especially on the kind of humanistic side. If you this is a guy with a lot of devotees, so if you go to Wikipedia and just look his name up, you'll find actually quite a comprehensive account of him. He's actually done programs for Channel 4 where he comments on film and things like this too, so he's very public. Žižek was invited by Birkbeck College to start a program in training public intellectuals. And the way he decided to do it, and I believe it still is going on in some sense, though again, I couldn't find the website again. I will show it to you, but I can't find the live website. I can give you the copy of the one I took 2 years ago. A series of seminars. In other words, the nature of the course was that you'd come to hear these famous people, each one a week, you know, sort of do their little public intellectual thing, and then you're supposed to be enlightened by this and somehow put together a paper or a dissertation or something out of this smorgasbord, okay? And so this too, even if that turns out to be successful, doesn't exactly give a kind of very strong sense of a disciplinary identity or a profession to the public intellectual. Now, there's a kind of obvious reason for this. All right, and I think this is something to be sort of put on the table at the outset, is that when we talk about disciplinary training, you know, like let's say we're not only sociology, but even a field that is very close to, you know, the public intellectual realm, like philosophy, we're basically talking about people who dedicate their lives to getting involved in certain traditions of posing and answering questions. And I really think that the most effective way of thinking about this matter, about what we do in academic life that makes it different from what a public intellectual does, is in terms of guilds. You know, you get a craft guild, right, where, you know, you learn to be able to be a carpenter, you know, or a cobbler making shoes in the old days, right? There are all these kinds of trades where you apprentice with a master for a certain number of years, and what you gain is sort of skills that you then are able to use in various settings to do good for people, to come up with products and so forth. But the quality of your work, right, is in the craftsmanship, right? It isn't necessarily in your personality as a craftsman, but in the fact that you do a good piece of work that can be recognized by the standards of the craft as a good piece of work. So when we talk about academic life, right, and you want to talk about whether someone is good or bad in their field, whether it be philosophy or sociology or physics or biology or whatever, right, we typically talk about the peer review process. And I'm sure you've all heard this expression, the peer review process, which basically means that other professionals judge your work. Right? So, and that kind of judgment is basically a craftsmanship judgment. Okay? It's intellectual craftsmanship, to be sure. It's not like, you know, it's not like usually a physical object to look at, right? Except perhaps a text, right? And when one is judging a text here. And you're not being, and typically when you pass muster in this peer review process, it's not because you have a brilliant personality or you're saying original things, but because you don't get stuff wrong. Right, and you're making a useful contribution to the field. Right, so in other words, they have to be able to place what you're doing in the context of an already existing problem set in your discipline. And then they can say, ah yes, we can see you're actually making a sort of step forward, you're getting closer to a solution to a problem that we in this field consider to be important. Okay? And that's how academic disciplines work, including philosophy. Now, if you have this kind of attitude toward intellectual life, in terms of if you want a theory to sort of attach on to what I've just been describing, you may know, some of you at least, you may know about Thomas Kuhn. How many of you have heard of Thomas Kuhn? Okay, a few. Good. The man's name's still around. Not G-Tech. He'd be disappointed. Under erasure. But Thomas Kuhn came up with this idea of science as a paradigm. And what I've just been describing is the paradigm, right? The paradigm is where within a scientific discipline, and in a sense, for purposes of this discussion, it doesn't have to be strict natural science. So that's what Kuhn was talking about. Right? We could actually be talking about sociology or philosophy or any of the other academic disciplines, right? There's a clear sense of what the defining problems of the field are at any given moment. And what constitutes competent working in that field, and what comes as making a useful contribution to solving standing problems in that field. And those kinds of judgments are the things that are done in the peer review process of academic life. And that is how we are, in fact, as academics, regularly judged. And so we publish in all these journals, right? And even when we publish books, unless we publish popular books, the books themselves are put through a similar kind of process where other people who are experts in the field will have to sign off and say this book is competent before it gets published. Okay? And there are a lot of major debates over what happens if academic work isn't peer-reviewed, right? Cases where things sort of slip through the cracks, as it were, and end up causing problems. Now, the interesting thing about the peer-review process, and this is something especially quite striking with regard to the natural sciences, is of course the natural sciences, when you publish an article in the natural sciences, the actual work that you've done is in a sense being reported in the article, right? When we do stuff in sociology and humanities, especially if we do more theoretical abstract stuff, often the thing that we're writing in the article is the knowledge. Right? I mean, in other words, sometimes, of course, we're doing surveys and interviews and things like that, and we're reporting those things. But a large part of what we write in our articles in the humanities and the social sciences, as it were, the knowledge is in the actual text. There is an external reference point, as it were, that is being reported upon. Sometimes there is, but often not. And certainly in humanities, it's not clear. And in philosophy, it's certainly not clear. But in the natural sciences, there's usually an experiment. There's usually some field work or something like that. And so the article is a report of that. And moreover, if you're the peer reviewer, if I'm the person being asked to judge whether this article should be published in the journal, I typically don't have the resources, the time, or given any kind of incentive to actually check whether what has been reported in this article actually occurred. So what do? I have to judge, there's this kind of face validity issue, right? In other words, the way the thing is written, it's written competently, it presents data that seems to follow from the things that the person claims to have done, it's a plausible doing what they claim to have done. So in other words, it's a craftsmanship issue at the end of the day. I really want to stress that, right? In other words, when you do a peer review judgment of a colleague in an academic field, it is a craftsmanship judgment because you're in no position to do an independent check of what they're doing most of the time. I mean, sometimes with computer-based work, you can sort of rerun things. But with most empirical experiments and surveys and things like this, you can't really redo what the person has done. So the only thing you can go on is how they present the material. So the craftsmanship in the writing is what counts. Okay. Now, see, I stress this point because it becomes very important then to have skills that you can demonstrate that other people already have and can evaluate. In other words, you don't get points for being a genius in this game, right? For coming up with some amazing thing that no one can figure out how you did it. I mean, it's very interesting, for example, if you look at somebody like Albert Einstein, right, who is a great physicist who overturned Newtonian mechanics with relativity theory in the beginning of the 20th century. He was working as a patent clerk in Switzerland at the time. In fact, he never finished his university degree or anything. Lots of stories about this kind of thing. And one of the interesting issues that arose when he first submitted his articles on relativity theory to be judged in physics journals was that he didn't quite write in the right way. So like a lot of his mathematical notation wasn't quite right. It wasn't that he made mistakes, but rather he was using outdated notation and stuff like this. And so the editor of the journal, Max Planck, one of the founders of quantum physics, he was the editor of the main journal in Germany in physics, he basically helped Einstein, kind of edit, rewrote a little bit, not in a substantive way, but in a way that, as it were, the craftsmanship side was taken care of. So it didn't look sloppy, it didn't look kind of weird, which would be, and in this business, if you write in a sloppy or weird way, that's good enough grounds to dismiss you, right, to sort of reject your article. If you don't write about stuff in the right way, and you don't cite the right sources, and you don't talk in the right language, right, you get dismissed. Okay? All of this is to show that in terms of academic life, right, we're primarily in this business of a kind of collective knowledge production process where personality matters for nothing. Okay? And your value comes from the contribution you make. I mean, Sir Isaac Newton very famously talked about, if I've seen as far as I have, it's because I stood in the shoulder of giants. Okay, so this is a classic example of someone who's very frequently called a genius, sort of saying, no, I'm just part of this whole lineage tradition of people, and I'm just making one more step. Okay, Max Weber, okay, in one of his final lectures to graduate students at the University of Munich, science is a vocation, okay, he makes this point, right, the whole point of being engaged in science and to understood in this sort of broad German sense of Wissenschaft, the sort of systematic pursuit of knowledge, including sociology and philosophy and all those other fields, is something where personality has nothing to do with it. It is about making a contribution to a sort of never-ending collective enterprise where you have to realize that you are going to be superseded. Others are going to come after you. You will be forgotten, but others will build on you. And if you're comfortable with that fate, then you should go into the academic bracket. But if you're not comfortable with that, if you're desirous of cult personality, then stay out of the business. That's kind of what his point is, right? As we're talking to these new graduate students, that's the context in which science is a vocation to deliver, right? New graduate students, and he's basically telling them what to expect if they go into academic life professionally, all right? Now, so I'm giving you this side of the academic story, right? Well, public intellectuals are really very different people from this kind of thing that I've been portraying about how one becomes an academic. Okay? I mean, what public intellectuals typically do, what is their kind of strong point, is, you might say, that they provide a kind of locus of judgment. Right? I mean, you think of the great public intellectuals, very often, especially once they die, I mean, when they're alive, they're very important people. They're very prominent people. They get a lot of coverage in newspapers, magazines, Then when they die, they disappear. Why? Well, because they're not part of any particular tradition, academic disciplinary tradition. So they don't get incorporated at all. They just fade away. And what's left? What's left? Well, what's left is not a substantive body of knowledge or belief or anything related to these people, even though these people wrote enormous amounts of stuff. Okay? But rather, there's a sense of a style. I mean, typically, intellectuals are associated, you know, particular intellectuals are associated with particular style. And that style comes, and what does, when we say style, we mean something quite specific here, right? Namely, a certain kind of attitude toward the world that, regardless of what they're talking about, comes out. It's like an aroma, almost, right? And so these people tend to have, you know, in terms of the sort of, you might say, historical unconscious of the world, they have a very long half-life. So people have heard of them, even though if you ask somebody, what did they actually stand for, they don't really know. So I'll give you an example. Voltaire. Have you heard of Voltaire?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me something he believed.
I don't know what I'm saying, which is basically, I don't agree with what you say, but I agree with your right.
Okay, so we got a motto. He got a motto out of Voltaire. All right. This is a man who lived like 80 years, wrote loads of books, incredibly involved in the, you know, the sort of heart and soul of the Enlightenment, 18th century Europe. And this is what it boils down to. A motto. Kind of thing you put on a bumper sticker. Okay? This is not uncommon. I'll give you another one. Okay, here's another one. Erasmus. Have you heard of him? Some of you have, right? Some few of you have. Okay. Great Renaissance humanist. Okay? Very important man. High schools are named after him in America. And, you know, there are universities named after him. What did he believe? Okay, he's a Renaissance humanist. What does that mean? Okay, again, same story, right? Here's another one for you. Bertrand Russell. Have you heard of him? What did he believe? This man wrote 70 books. Most was voted by Time Magazine in 1970-something as the most important intellectual figure of the 20th century. What did he say? I mean, and this is really Jean-Paul Sartre. You heard him. What did he believe?
Existential.
All right, we got a word. We got a word for that one. Yes, yes. You see, I mean, this is a very common kind of thing, right? Where these people, in a sense, they sort of, if you want to put it charitably, what happens is these public intellectuals become kind of attached with a kind of time, maybe a kind of, you know, mood. Right? So, you know, one thinks about Jean-Paul Sartre, one thinks of, you know, Ingmar Bergman films and, you know, the 50s and, you know, people looking very pensive and speaking gnomingly to each other, you know, maybe listening some kind of, you know, beat music in the background. You know, right? And that's very typical, right? There's images that one has of public intellect in terms of kind of a lifestyle, a kind of an attitude, but very hard to actually come down to talk about substantive belief, knowledge, and so forth that have kind of carried through that other people have built upon. Okay? And that's because, public intellectual life, at the end of the day, is about displaying a sense of judgment. And this is a very important point, because I think very often, one of the things that we don't really get very well trained to do in academic life, those of us who actually become professional academics, is we don't get judged very well, we don't get trained very well to judge things that are not on our own terms. So we do get, obviously we get trained so that we can evaluate whether somebody working in our field knows what they're doing. Of course, we can do that, right? But when something is slightly off our turf, right, where there's, as it were, a lot of different issues involved, right, which somehow have to be weighed in the balance, you know, the kind of thing, I guess, you might say that a judge has to often, you know, like when a judge faces a case in court, right, a case is never just about one thing, right? I mean, a case may be characterized as being about one thing, but there are lots of different issues at play, issues having to do with the nature of the personalities involved, and issues having to do with the nature of the larger doctrines of the law that are under contestation, issues having to do with the sort of political environment in which this decision is going to have to be taken, right? All of these things have to be kind of kept in the balance, and then the judge makes a decision weighing these things and laying that stuff out. Okay? Public intellectuals do that, right? They do that kind of activity. They have a power of judgment. And this is something that actually academics are not particularly well trained to do. Okay? I mean, our inclination when faced with this kind of complex situation is to say, this is not my expertise. Somebody else ought to be dealing with it. Not my problem. I'm just a specialist in, 19th century nose picking or something, okay? Don't give me these big issues to deal with that involve all this complexity and stuff like that, okay? And so it's often very, a characteristic feature when you get an academic on radio and they're kind of a virgin with regard to the media and they get posed a question by, the sort of John Humphreys type guy who's going to ask a very blunt sort of in-your-face question, they'll start by saying, this is a very complicated matter, and you feel like, shut this clown up, right? Because if that's the first, yes, of course we know it's a complicated matter. That's why we're asking you the question, right? What you're being asked to do when you're issuing a judgment, right, is to cut through the complexity, right, to resolve the complexity. That's the whole idea of making a judgment, is to say what matters, what doesn't matter, to what extent. Judges do this all the time in legal proceedings. The difference being, of course, the judges, in a sense, they can set their own time frame with regard to delivering judgments, and they can deliver the judgments at whatever length they feel like, and often it goes to hundreds of pages. Okay? And also they have, they have the force of law behind them, so even if their stuff is very esoteric and nobody can quite make sense of it, they've got all of the police and all the rest of the people to enforce this stuff, so they don't have to really persuade anybody. Okay? Whereas public intellectuals are in a much more politically diminished state, you might say. They're just like, in that respect, they're like ordinary people. It's just this one person who's taking all of this stuff into account, weighing the different sides of the argument, and then delivering a judgment, and basically leaving it up to you, the reader, to decide whether you buy it or not buy it, but in any case, forcing you to have a stand yourself. I mean, that's where public intellectuals are very effective in that respect. They kind of call you to account, right? They say, look, here's what I think about this, and you read this stuff and say, whoa, I'm provoked. I agree or I don't agree, but I'm provoked. And that's what a public intellectual does. But this kind of activity is very difficult to train, and it's not the kind of thing that lends itself to academic training. Okay? Not only doesn't it lend itself to academic training, there are actually a lot of disincentives within academia to be a public intellectual. Because as in this university, not just this university, I don't want to put the burden here, but across universities in Britain, of course, we are judged primarily on our research performance, which has to do with our contributions to these peer-reviewed journals that I was just talking about. Okay? Now, there are still people who take teaching seriously and all that. I don't think, that hasn't gone out the window. But there is really very little incentive, when it gets right down to it, to focus primarily on teaching if you're an academic. I think that's pretty strict. People who go into academia may have a great desire to teach and urge to teach and like teaching better than anything else they do. I'm not denying that. But within the institutional structure of academic life, in this country, but not just this country, research is really what matters. Okay? So what that means is you are primarily being paid, this is what it boils down to, for the degree to which you successfully orient yourself to your colleagues. That's pretty much what it boils down to, right? I mean, your salary and your promotions and your raises and all the rest of it are not tied to your dealings with students, let alone the larger public. You see, if we emphasize teaching more in academia, and we actually, for example, train people how to teach, what a novel idea, that doesn't happen, what would that mean would be that it would at least be a regular opportunity for academics to actually talk to people who, on the one hand, don't already know all the stuff they know, so they're not peers in that sense, but also people like yourselves who may be majoring in sociology, but very few, if any of you, are actually going to become sociologists. Right? And so the point here is, in a sense, it is like dealing with the public. Because these are people who think that, you're people who think, well, maybe I have something important or interesting to say, but it's not necessarily because you think of yourselves as contributing to the fields that I've contributed to. It's because you've got other things in your lives that you think this might be of relevance to. Now, that's the perfect kind of setting for public intellectual life to be nurtured, it seems to me. But there's very little incentive in academia to actually encourage this kind of behavior. And by the way, one of the reasons for that is because it's not easily measurable. I think that's a very important part of the issue here, that the measurability factor counts a lot in all these things of evaluation. But that's for another day. So what happens? What ends up happening then is you get a lot of people saying, okay, regardless of whether you can train people for being a public intellectual, if you want to be a public intellectual, you have to somehow have a kind of substantive expertise to begin with, because otherwise people aren't going to take you seriously. Okay. Now, that's an interesting point. I think there is a certain amount of truth to this. Certain amount of truth. A very small amount of truth. That is to say, it is important perhaps that you have a first degree in a subject. So like what you guys are getting now. But I think that's about as far as it goes when it gets right down to it. Historically, that's about as far as it's gone. Okay? I mean, people like Richard Dawkins, for example, who have these kinds of, you know, really prestigious credentials with regard to his training at Oxford in zoology and all this, you know, stopped doing research when he was in his early 30s. Okay, so the man has no research record to speak of. He's just got these very important books that are in the public sphere that have helped to define the public understanding of biology. And that's what his chair is in. And that is quite a characteristic thing. So somebody like Steven Pinker, for example, who you know now has this, he wrote the book The Blank Slate and some other books before that, and now he's got a book out called The Stuff of Thought. Okay? Have people, you run into this Pinker? Oh, you haven't? Okay. The book is being reviewed now, actually, in newspapers and things. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard. He's, I think, doing a lecture tour now in this country. The interesting thing about, and he's a kind of evolutionary psychologist. Okay, so he's very much kind of on the same wavelength as Dawkins, but he's pushing it on the psychology side. Pinker is someone who, when I was a student, a graduate student, 25 years ago, was known as a person who worked on the development of language in children. That's where his research specialty was, okay, when he was at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And then, by the mid-80s, late 80s, he sort of left that and then started writing all these popular books. And then he moved to Harvard and he just does this stuff, okay? And so if you look at his research record, right, it's also, you know, it was promising, but then it stopped. And the stuff that he writes about in his popular books, and the same applies to Dawkins, rarely ever relates the stuff he himself has done. Right? So when these people are popularizing science and presenting certain kinds of worldviews on behalf of science, they are not reporting their own research. So it's not science popularization in the literal sense of saying, I've done some technical science, now I'm going to make ordinary people understand it. No, it's not that. What they're doing is something different. It is much more a public intellectual function, because what they're doing is they're taking a lot of research that's out there in many different places, and they're configuring it in a way and spinning it, you might say, right? Giving a kind of spin that then has a certain kind of public relevance that the research by itself wouldn't necessarily have, okay? So there's a sense in which what guys like Pinker and Dawkins, right, even though they have this scientific background and so forth, the credibility and the value of what they do isn't tied to that, right? There's a kind of value added in their public intellectual work. They are actually doing something constructive and something novel in their public intellectual work that goes way beyond the stuff that they're talking about. Okay? And this is why you get people within biology, for example, contesting what Dawkins has to say about evolution. Right? Dawkins is a kind of genetic reductionist at the end of the day. And, you know, a lot of biologists think that that's not really the right way to go with regard to evolution. And so they have problems with him. I mean, interestingly, the only person who really consistently contested Dawkins publicly was this guy, Stephen Jay Gould. People familiar with him? How many have heard of Stephen Jay Gould? You heard. Okay. This is an example of another example of public intellectuals just evaporating once they die. This man, let me tell you, this man was regarded as the most important popular, he was regarded as more significant than Dawkins, believe it or not. I know it's hard to believe now. But they're both of the same vintage, both roughly the same age, both born about 1940. And they both started to get going in the late 70s. And through a kind of a 25-year period, they basically had these kind of dueling books. Okay, so Stephen Jay Gould wrote books like Wonderful Life, The Mismeasure of Man, Bully for Brontosaurus, you know, all these kinds of books. They were all best-selling books, very much like Dawkins' books. Gould was a professor at Harvard, American, and Dawkins and Gould would be in all these debates, and there are now even books written about the debates. Gould died in 2002. That's really bad, you know. If you die and you're a public intellectual, you're gone. And so Dawkins is just kind of colonized the field. He's still alive, kicking, starting up his atheism foundation. That guy's going to be around forever. Okay? But if you were to look, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago, there was a real kind of public fight about the nature of evolution. Okay? You know, it's very interesting. And Gould was often, because Gould had a lot of reservations about natural selection theory, he was often accused of providing comfort for creationists, because he didn't have this kind of gung-ho view about evolution the way Dawkins does. But now that Gould is gone, all the evolutionists are kind of unified around Dawkins. And of course, the whole creationism thing has become much stronger, actually, in the last 5 years. Okay. So the nature of the public debate over this has changed simply by one person leaving the field. Okay. Now, there's no successor to Gould. Gould wasn't the kind, public intellectuals don't have students. There are no students of Dawkins to speak of who are going to care. So Dawkins has this chair in the public understanding of science that's being funded by this rich Hungarian guy, Charles Simony, who's one of these rich guys who likes to go off into space, you know, pay $25 million or whatever it costs, right, to fly around, orbit the Earth for a while. That's the kind of thing he does. And he funded Dawkins' chair. Dawkins is retiring this year. Is anyone going to replace Dawkins? It's not at all clear. It's a one-shot chair, folding chair, you might say, right? I mean, he retires and ends at the chair. Who would replace him? And this is very, and in a way, this is a way, you might say, of academically marking public intellectuals. Namely, yes, there's this one-off guy. He does his thing for 25 years. He disappears. End of story. Okay. It'd be interesting to see if there is a successor. But as far as I know, they're not doing a search. They're not doing a search for successor to Dawkins. Okay. So the business here is that there may be some sort of small advantage to be gained by having some kind of original academic degree in the subject, right? But that only gets you so far, because in fact the public intellectuals do say things that you're not going to be able to find in the technical literature. They do make claims that go way beyond the stuff that they're talking about, often in ways, usually in ways, that are very controversial. You know, so the question then becomes, what is the value of doing this? And I think the value at the end of the day has to be a general enlightenment function. And here I think one has to sort of think about what this enlightenment idea is about, because this gets very much tossed around, not only when discussing intellectuals, but generally as a cultural phenomenon. And I want to when I finish talking about the enlightenment, I want to talk about the university in the context of this, because the reinvention of the modern university, that's to say, a university that involves the integration of teaching and research, because I don't want to give you the history of the university now, but the basic point is that until the beginning of the 19th century, for the most part, I mean, when universities were founded in the Middle Ages, they were very radical kinds of places. Okay, but when you get, by the time you get to the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, universities are very conservative places, and most of the intellectual action, whether we're talking about the Renaissance or Scientific Revolution or any of these things that we associate with, you know, the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, most of those things are actually happening outside of universities. Universities are always playing catch-up with intellectual life, which seems to be happening offstage. Okay? But then in the beginning of the 19th century in Germany, you start to get this idea that the university is the place of enlightenment, where enlightenment has to do with the integration of teaching and research. Namely, you have these scholars who are pushing the frontiers of knowledge, and they have this kind of duty to kind of make it known to everybody for general public enlightenment. And this is kind of the modern university idea. The university idea as this kind of progressive, dynamic, forward-looking kind of place. Okay? And so the university then gets identified with the Enlightenment, and this happens at the very beginning of the 19th century. But before that time, universities are seen as very anti-Enlightenment, and the movement that we call the Enlightenment from the 18th century, Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, all these people, right, you've heard all these French guys, they are all anti-university people. Because they see the university as the place where the church has its domination, where people are just trained to become bureaucrats, either ecclesiastical bureaucrats or civil bureaucrats, right? Where there's no original thinking going on, there's no research going on, it's just kind of, you know, it's very much a kind of, a, you know, the Max Weber, if you've ever read Max Weber's stuff on China, what he says about Confucianism, about how this becomes this way, the way bureaucracy, and, you know, they memorize Confucian texts, and then they just sort of write them down, and if they can write them down the right way, they get their jobs in the civil service. Well, in a sense, this is how the 18th century Enlightenment saw universities. So the Enlightenment is happening in the 18th century outside the universities. And it's in this period that you actually get the establishment of what we would now call research institutes. Right, and scientific academies, and these kinds of extra university bodies where knowledge is produced and disseminated. Okay. Now, so the point here is that enlightenment here has to be understood in a very particular way that originates outside the university. But what is the enlightenment about that has to do with public intellectual life? Well, Kant talks about it in a way that I think kind of raises, you know, clearly what the value of what these guys do. He talks about it. Kant, by the way, is the person who's normally credited with having coined the term enlightenment. Okay? Aufklärung. But he does this at the very end of the Enlightenment. This is something, by the way, I think is always worth noting when you people who, you know, think about things historically. We've got all these periods in history, right? But typically, always, almost always, they get named after the fact. Right, so in other words, a period has already passed, and then somebody decides to give it a name. It's not like, okay, we're going to start this period. Hey, let's do enlightenment. It goes like this. Right, no, it doesn't happen that way. Right? So the enlightenment, let's say, begins in the middle of the 17th century and ends with 1800, a French Revolution or something like that. Okay, but it's only at the end, and Kant is writing like in the 1780s, 1790s, right, that it gets, you know, he starts to think, wow, what's been going on for the last 150 years? It's been enlightenment, okay? And so he talks, he has this essay called, What is Enlightenment? And that's where the term gets put, and he's talking about what was been happening for the previous 150 years. Okay? And the thing that Kant emphasizes about characteristic feature of enlightenment is human beings being released from a state of knownage. Knownage. Do you know what this word means? Knownage? It's an old word. It's the opposite of dotage. You know what dotage means? That should be a more familiar word. No? You know what dotage means. Okay, what does that dotage mean? If I could put you on the spot there.
Dotage is like, it's like a type of talent that you have, or like you understand something.
No, I think you're thinking of something else. No, that's not what it is. Dotage is when you're old. Your old age is dotage. Knownage is when you're a kid. In the case of knownage, dotage. All right. And the idea here is that the point that Kant was trying to make was that in most societies up to this point of the Enlightenment, people have been treated like kids. Adults included, right? I mean, and the idea, in other words, they're not allowed to think for themselves. They're not allowed to make decisions for themselves, right? And so what Kant is imagining are societies that are governed by monarchies with dynasties, where people don't have the right to vote in elections, where there is no free press, there is no active participation in politics, and where there, in fact, on the contrary, there is a concern that if people were to find out things, it would be destabilizing to the society. So in other words, you can't trust people with ideas or knowledge, because it'll be troublesome. And so what you do then is you adopt, you might say, kind of paternalistic attitude toward people. And this is a view of, you know, those of you who know about the history of politics, this is a very anti-democratic sensibility, goes back to Plato. And so in fact, a lot of the people who have in fact supported this view of treating human beings in this childlike state have been philosophers. Philosophers who are concerned about the truth, and the truth being something that is really radically different from what people ordinarily believe, and that if you were to actually lay it out to them, that people would either not understand it, or it would just totally fry their brains. Right? So what you have to do instead is you have to give them these myths, these noble lies, as Plato called it, right? You have to mediate it, but in any case, you can't give them direct access to the truth, because God knows what they'll do with it. So that's human beings in the state of notage, right? And the Enlightenment is against that. So there's a sense in which, you know, what Kant and all these guys in the Enlightenment are attacking is a certain very strong tradition in the history of philosophy, and of course the history of theology with the church and all this, right, where you have a clear sense of authority and hierarchy, and, you know, certain people, as it were, are empowered to know the truth because their minds are capable of absorbing it, and they're not going to start going crazy once they find out about it. Whereas there's other people, right, who aren't capable. Maybe not only because they're not intellectually capable, but also because you can't trust them with it. You can't trust people with the information. God knows what they'll do. Okay? And so this justifies censorship and all this kind of stuff. But what happens in the Enlightenment, of course, is you start to get the beginnings of a so-called public sphere, right? And Habermas, the German social theorist, his first book, first major book, the one that, first, certainly the oldest book of his translated to English, is called The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere. And it's about this, right? It's basically about the social and political conditions under which something like Enlightenment makes sense. And this has to do with the rise of newspapers, right, and the rise of a kind of a middle class that in a way has discretionary income and can start subscribing to book series and things that provided alternative sources of information that you could keep in the home and you could consult and get a different view from the view that's being given to you by the government or the church. Okay, and that's what the Enlightenment's about. So it's like the dawning of a kind of media age, and it's releasing people from their notage. Now, what that means then is that you are basically, if you're released from your notage, then you have responsibility to think for yourself. And Kant has this slogan, dare to know, right? In other words, you are now responsible for what you think, right? And what the public intellectual does is, the public intellectual, as it were, puts you in that position by giving you a very strict, you know, telling, look, here's the war in Iraq, here are all these issues, and here's where I stand. And then you look at what this guy has written, and you're forced to take a stand. Do you agree or disagree? If you disagree, why do you disagree? If you agree, why do you agree? Right? And that's the kind of thing that the Enlightenment made possible. This whole idea that people had stakes in all of these kinds of issues. That these were not issues to be left to others to decide for them. Right? Again, being a child means you have other people deciding things for you. And you just follow along what they say. But the public intellectual is going to make a statement directly. So, you think about it. It's an interesting point, right? Here we've got all of these politicians, diplomats, policymakers, all trying to figure out what to do about the war in Iraq, okay? And these are the guys, as it were, are the actors, right? These are the guys who are doing the stuff that's going to determine whether the war goes on, how long it goes on, etc. So meanwhile, of course, in the newspapers and magazines and books, right, there are people who are intellectuals who are talking about this and are, as it were, living a kind of shadow existence, you might say, thinking about exactly the same issues, weighing the same kinds of options the policy guys are weighing, and talking about them publicly, often reaching radically different conclusions from what the politicians are doing, and influencing people in the process of making their own views public. Now you see, think about that. You know, at one level, I think it's easy to understand why people in that time, in the 18th century and before, thought, wow, what a disturbing idea. Here I am trying to sort out the war with all these guys. You know, Saddam Hussein is crazy enough as it stands, and now I've got to worry about all these journalists saying shit. Okay, and sometimes you do get politicians complaining, right, about how the newspapers are kind of undermining efforts and, you know, at diplomacy and negotiation and stuff like that, right? And you do get politicians grumbling about this, but we are sufficiently on the pro side of enlightenment that we tolerate that. But you see, the interesting thing is it took a long time to get people, you know, give people the courage to think, yes, you can actually allow a lot of discussion about the way in which the world is. And so it doesn't have to just be left to the policymakers and politicians to talk about. Ordinary people can talk about it and make their own decisions as well. Okay? And yes, it'll cause a certain degree of stability. It may cause certain politicians to lose their jobs in the next election, for example. Right? If they're not able to answer a lot of this stuff that's sort of happening around them, over which they have no control. They don't have control over the journalists. So journalists will say all kinds of things. Some journalists might come up with a really decisive issue, and the politician fumbles, okay? But that's tolerable, right? That's what democracy is about. And that's what the Enlightenment was about, you see? It was about that, precisely, okay? And at that time, the universities were very much against all this. Because the universities were in the business of manufacturing the elites, right? Whether they be the elites of the church or the elites of the state. And those were the people who were going to have the jobs of actually doing the everyday life of politics. They were the ones who were going to be doing the warmongering and the diplomacy and all the rest of it. And the last thing that they wanted would be this whole kind of penumbra of people who were also jabbering about the same issues and potentially destabilizing what's going on. Okay? But that is in fact what the Enlightenment was about. It was about opening up that space. As it were, being comfortable with that degree of volatility and instability of judgment. Because you've got more and more people delivering judgments on things. That you know, have real-world consequences to them, okay? And so that's the important thing about the Enlightenment. And so then the great trick that you get in the beginning of the 19th century, and I'll end here and talk about it more next time, is the university. How does the university become a place where, as it were, enlightenment itself can be manufactured, right? Because in a sense, that's what we're trying to do in universities today. Rather than just manufacture elites, which I suppose we do all, you know, by our selection procedures, we're also, in some sense, trying to manufacture enlightenment for generation after generation, to get people more engaged in the world as public intellectuals, even if they don't go into academic life, okay? And how that trick is pulled, I'll talk about that later. But let me just, in closing here, I just want to remind you that next Monday, I will be visiting the seminars, right? It's Monday. And see how you're doing with the Wikipedia stuff and, you know, issues you want to raise about that. You can raise that with me because this is all in preparation for coming up with your CEST essay questions and the kinds of things that would be worth asking you to write about given the way you've been dealing with the Wikipedia stuff. Okay? So you'll see me both next Monday and next Wednesday. All right? Would there be a problem with my getting into this place?